So enjoy, and let me introduce Mick Bolton. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good evening. First of all, let me just check. For whom is this the very first ever London lecture? Hands up. Wow, quite a few of you. Great. Okay. And who's been before? The rest of you. Obviously. Logic speaks. So I just want to explain what London lectures are for. So we run this every 2 months. And the idea of a London lecture is to explore what I consider to be the boundaries of coaching. You know, when I started coaching many years ago, coaching was very much a behavioral approach to change. We looked at what somebody wanted, how they moved towards it, and we set goals and that kind of stuff. But the truth is that as you start to coach in any serious sense, you start to realize that the human being is so much more than a goal that they set or a behavior that they choose to do. And you start to realize that there are a whole set of expectations, assumptions, if you like, an existential paradigm that underlies their way of being in the world. And we set up these lectures as a way to address certain questions within that. And so tonight I want to address the question of the temporal self. I was very curious about how Rob said it, the temporal self. And it made me think about tempura, and I wondered if we sort of batter some people and serve them on a little plate. But now this is the temporal self. And I want to, first of all, just get started by introducing myself. Who here has no idea who I am, just so I understand who's... Okay, cool. I thought about a check. It's quite nice. Only two of you don't know, which is nice. So let me explain who I am. I'm Nick Bolton. I'm the founder of Animas Centre for Coaching. I've been a coach for around 17 years, working in group coaching initially, particularly in the public sector for police officers, social workers, retrained as a life coach some years later, and set up my first school in 2008, which was then the Smart School. We changed as Animas in 2013 for a key reason, which is when I set up the school, it was still that old approach to coaching, which was role model-based coaching. But the truth is, we don't really coach like that. We coach the human being in front of us. And so Animas represents that idea of living life courageously. One of the things I've noticed about how people choose to live their life is the existential paradigm they have. And one of those existential realities is time. Like, let me ask you, do any of you exist outside of time? Not at all, of course not. The question is, how do you relate to time? What is your relationship with time that influences how you live on a day-to-day, week-to-week, year-to-year, lifetime-to-lifetime basis? And I think that it's one of those questions that we don't really think about. What is my relationship to time? Do I think about the past? Do I think about the future? Do I think about the present? So this evening, I want to be really addressing those kind of key questions to look at how do you as coaches start to have those conversations or notice the issues within somebody's sort of story that relate to time. What I'm hoping to leave you with, by the way, is never, ever, ever how to do things. It's just not my style. What I'd love to leave you with is ideas, thoughts, questions, considerations, lenses to drop over your optician's glasses. I often think of coaching as being like, you know, when you go, who's been to the optician? Some of you are wearing glasses and some of you had laser surgery. And okay, so you go to the opticians and they put those kind of medieval contraptions on you. Remember that? They go like, choof. And then they drop these lenses in and they say, is that clearer? Less clear. Clearer? Less clear. And eventually you get to this point where you've got no idea. You're like, literally, it looks okay to me. And I kind of think that's what coaching is about, in the sense of what we try to do as a coach is drop different lenses over somebody's lived experience and ask, is that clearer or less clear as a way to look at your life? And I think time is one of those lenses we can drop over. So I will not, I promise you, be telling you this is how to do coaching. This is how to work with time. I'll be offering you ideas which you can take away and play with. That's it. How you start to integrate time ideas into your coaches is entirely up to you and your clients to figure out. I've also got a little question for you. Whenever I come up with these talks, I always come up with as Rob said, what was your phrase, Rob? Trips off the tongue. I always come up with titles that go on for ages. The temporal self, a unified view of time and identity in coaching. But the reason why I do that is because it will create ideas in you even before you arrive here. If I say to you this evening is about the GROW model, or this is about cognitive behavioral coaching, or this is about transactional analysis coaching, you kind of know what you're going to get. You know, it does what it says on the tin. I'm really curious about what sense you make of it even before you get into this room. What does the temporal self mean to you? What do you expect to get this evening? What on earth do you think I'm going to talk about? Like, that stuff that happens in your brain even before you walk down into this hallowed hall, even before that happens, is really important, because I see life as all about meaning making. Nothing that I say to you today, I promise you, other than my name, is true. But nor is it false. It's just something we can start to create meaning from. And I'm curious what meaning you created from this title, even before we started talking about it. So, what I'd love you to do is have a chat with your neighbour, and just at this point in time, ask yourself this. What does the phrase, the temporal self, conjure up for you? What on earth do you think that is about? Have a little chat with your neighbour, and I'll check in with you in a couple of minutes. Okay, I'm going to move on and share what it's definitely not about tonight. Because there are, as you guys have already said, there are different ways of looking at this, and some of them are sort of in what I'm going to be covering, some of them aren't. So here's what it's not about, but definitely could be, with just as many laughs as you're going to get tonight when we talk about my version of temporal self. So number one, it's not about chronological time or linear narrative tonight. It could be. It could be about how do you place yourself across a trajectory of time. It could be about social roles and maturation, i.e. if you think about people like Eric Erickson and his developmental psychology, the idea that as we go through life, there are stages we have to grow through and crises we have to face. It's not about that. It's not about death, mortality, or impermanence. But of course it is. It just always is. But it's not explicitly tonight. It's not about developmental psychology, the likes of Erickson, Torbert, and who's the other guy? Robert Keegan. It's not about that. It's not about socio-historic conditioning. So it's not about the fact you can't wake up tomorrow as a Roman emperor. That's true too, but it's not about that. If you want to wake up as a Roman emperor tomorrow, tough. You've got to deal with that, but it's not about that. Nor is it about time management or time anxiety or any of that sort of practical day-to-day stuff around time. It's not about that. What it is about is this, roughly. And the reason why I use PowerPoint, by the way, is because I'm 47 years old. And at 47, you start forgetting stuff. Literally, I always want to, I know what I want to say in these talks. And the minute I stand up, stuff starts just popping out of my head. I step up to say, hi, I'm Nick Bolton. I literally forget my name. So I decided to use PowerPoint tonight just to remind myself of the key points. So here's what it's about. It's about time perspectives. And it's a particular psychological model by a guy called Philip Zimbardo. Some of you might know Philip, if you know him by his first name, was the guy that ran the Stanford experiment, the prison experiment that went dreadfully wrong. He wrote a book called The Time Paradox, in which he looked at how most human beings have a particular relationship to time which impacts how they live. Now, I am not in any way a psychologist, so I will not in any way be giving you a model to diagnose people with. But nonetheless, it offers us an interesting lens for use. We will be looking at self-concept, and this is something I'm very, very keen on and done a lot of work on, which is how does somebody make sense of their self, as in self with a capital S. So what is their self-concept? How do they construct their notion of their being? It's about emotions of time. Where do emotions sit? What do emotions relate to when it comes to temporality? It's also about problems of time tonight. And finally, it's around coaching around time. And apologies if you can't see the bottom, but you won't miss anything because I'll be reading it for you. But it's about how do you coach around it? But I won't be saying how to do it. I'll be just offering you some reflections, some ideas on how you could coach. I have my way of coaching. Might not be your way. You might find much better ways of working with time than I've got, but I'll offer you some thoughts. So some caveats. I feel like these are quite important for me to get on the table. First of all, I'm a coach. I'm not a psychologist. I do consider myself a bit of a philosopher. So I'm completing a dissertation this year on identity and time. So I love the philosophy of coaching, but I don't study it in a sort of experimental lab. So I'm not doing any sort of tests on monkeys or white rats or astronauts. This is just sense making from my own experience of coaching. That's it. I'm not going to do any references. I'm not going to point to any books apart from Philip Zimbardo. This is just how I think of what I've been through as a coach and the work I've done. And the last thing is that I'm just offering you ideas. This is not, and I really want to be explicit with this, it's not a diagnostic tool. If you walk out of here tonight thinking you've got a diagnostic tool to use with your clients, you've already lost the plot as a coach. So, why this topic? A few reasons. I am fascinated by our ability to ignore time's passing. Really fascinated. As an entrepreneur, you never stop moving. And by the way, I consider myself an entrepreneur more than a coach. And I think as an entrepreneur, you get so used to moving and changing and adapting and growing. And I'm amazed at how long people get stuck with problems in their life, whether it's relationship problems, whether it's business problems, whether it's family problems, whether it's any kind of problem at all, physical problems. I'm amazed at how long people stay stuck with stuff they can sort out. And that feels to me a time issue. It's like somebody said earlier, I think it was Peter, said about the idea that we can ignore that time is passing, we're not doing anything about it. I'm also very, very intrigued by our relationship to existential facticity. I love these words. Existential facticity is those things about being human that you can't escape. They are just facts. We exist in time. And by the way, if you can prove me wrong, go for it. But so far, I've only ever seen people exist in time. Equally, you're all going to die. Equally, you've all got bodies. Equally, that you all have a separate self from other selves, etc., etc. That's just what's called facticity. But it's our relationship to the facticity which defines how we live. In other words, how do we relate to having a self that's differentiated? How do we relate to the fact that we have to make choices? How do we relate to the fact that we live through time? How do we relate to the fact we're going to die? That's our individual relationship to that fact. Make sense? And I'm always fascinated by how one's paradigm of those facticities coming into your life lead you to live the life the way you do. Whether that's being powerful or submissive or victim or aggressor, whatever it might be happy, be sad, I don't care. I'm curious about what is that paradigm that you've formed through your life that's led you to be that person. I became really curious about how time and identity started to impact each other, and in particular, because of some work I did with a client who I'll be walking you through tonight. I've given him a fake name. Some of you actually know it because I recorded the sessions for our learning zone. So if you're one of our coaches, you can actually listen to the coaching with this guy. But for this, I've changed his name. So the client's Paul. I'm just going to walk you through. I'm not going to go into too much detail at this stage. I want to go through Paul's basic starting point, cover some theory, then bring it back to how this worked with Paul. So Paul was a rugby player. Halfway through his career as a rugby player, he had a massive injury in his what's my doodle face. What's it called? The Achilles heel. And he couldn't play rugby again. So he thought, no problem, I will become a Marine. He became a Marine, and he had cardio something, which meant he had his heart sort of part exploded. So he couldn't be a Marine anymore. He came to me saying he was stuck in the past. He knew what he wanted to work towards. He knew he wanted to start a business, but he wasn't doing it. He knew what he wanted to do with his family, but he wasn't doing it. He said he found himself. Let me just check. How many of you listen to my sessions online? Yeah, some of you. Cool. He said he found himself on websites looking at joining the Army Reserves again, knowing full well as an existential facticity that he couldn't. He couldn't because of his heart condition. There was no way he could join the Army Reserves. Couldn't happen. But he would find himself at this website dreaming of his past. And he said to me, Nick, I want to move forward, but I can't let go of my past. And I got really curious. What is the identity that's been projected back into the past or brought forward from the past to the present day? He was also very resentful of people in his life, particularly his wife, who he didn't feel understood him. Understood him? Yeah, understood him, past tense. and his doctor. And the doctor had said to him something like, you can still be fit. Just go for a walk in the park. And he was like, do you not realize I was a rugby player and then I was a Marine and you're saying I should be happy going for a walk in the park? So he was stuck and he was angry that people didn't understand him. But he also wasn't sharing what he was feeling. He wasn't allowing himself to be felt or seen by other people around him. And for him, when I looked at him, I was like, wow, your future is just second best for you. The future you wanted for yourself was either the successful rugby player or, give or take a few guns, successful Marine. But he's got neither. And so his future became second best. It was the thing he didn't want. His present was very frustrated. He felt frustrated by the people around him. He felt frustrated by himself. And his future felt... felt second best. His past felt like his halcyon days. It reminds me of me when I was 28 and I left my first wife. I will say first wife, which you go like, how many did he have? Two, for the record. But when I left my first wife, and I was 28 years old, and somebody said, are you ambitious, Nick? And I said, no, my ambitious days are behind me. At the age of 28, you know yourself so well at 28. Who thought I'd be an entrepreneur at 30? Like, it's funny how we make sense of ourselves in time. And I thought back then, that was my ambitious time. So let's leave Paul and come back to him a little bit later. Just want to define what I mean by temporal self, and it's this. The temporal self reflects how we make sense of ourselves in the here and now, in relation to ourselves as remembered, experienced, and projected through time, the past, the present, and the future. Notice that critical phrase, as we make sense of ourselves in the here and now. That's why this is not about narrative per se. This is not about actually what happened or what might happen. This is about how do I experience myself in the here and now in relation to myself in time. Let me explain that in a bit more detail. I want to look at Philip Zimbardo's time perspectives as a starting point for this. He wrote a book called The Time Paradox. As I said, he's the guy that did the Stanford prison experiment that went dreadfully wrong and they made a film of and all that malarkey. He redeemed himself with The Time Paradox by playing super safe, by not putting people in prisons. And he came up with this concept that we are all guided by time, but that we all have a particular preference for where we look. And we can look at the past, we can look at our present situation, or we can look to the future. And in a way, we look at all of them, but we have a preference. And where we have that preference will determine how we start to live our life. And there are essentially six kind of, or seven. I've actually added one, which I'll share with you in a second. There are seven modalities as I see it. The first is the past positive. So this was, if you like, my client's perspective, Paul. He was past positive. In other words, he thought the positive stuff was in the past. Actually, funnily enough, he's also past negative, in as much as there's a lot of anger in the past that he's lost it. But in terms of where he thinks the good stuff is, it's there in the past. Then there's past negative. This is the person that's come and they've been abused and they still carry that abuse with them. Or the person that got sacked and they still carry that fact they were made unemployed with them, etc., etc. So they're still drawing the negative stuff from the past into the present. Then there's the present, which is the present hedonistic. Present hedonistic is the person that experiences the present, who enjoys living in the moment. So it could be, you know, when you go out for a meal, hopefully you're not dwelling on being sacked 10 years before. You might be, but hopefully you're enjoying it. That's a present hedonistic moment. And equally alongside the present is the present fatalistic, which is the person that feels they don't have control over their current state. Whatever I do, it's going to happen anyway. That's the present hedonistic time perspective. Looking to the future, we have future plans oriented. So this is the person that's always planning ahead, thinking of what's their next move. How are they going to grow their business? How are they going to find their girlfriend? How are they going to get fit? How are they going to dot, dot, dot? Absolute classic coaching lens, if you like, isn't it? If you think about most coaching, it tends to be future oriented. Then this is my addition, future fearful. I was curious actually that Zimbardo didn't include this. It seems really obvious to me that future fearful is, or some equivalent to that name, should be a lens, which is some people live now fearing what comes next. And the last one is future transcendental, which is living for what comes next in life. So maybe it's heaven, maybe it's you know, reincarnation, achieving nirvana, whatever it might be. There's going to be some kind of preference for you. Now, I'm curious, even as you look at those now, what's coming up for you? So I'd like you, just for a second, maybe just a minute, chat to your neighbour and start to notice which of these feels like where you tend to put your time. Interesting, I didn't mean that as a pun, but there you go. So just have a little chat for about a minute. Where do you find yourself, your energy drawn to that? Okay, self-concept. So a self-concept for me, and this is not in a dictionary somewhere, this is my sense-making of self-concept, is this. It's a cognitive and affective schema for how someone currently experiences the nature of their self. It's a cognitive and affective schema for how someone currently experiences the nature of their self. In other words, it's not purely a thought thing, it's a felt thing. My gut feeling of self-concept is it's not always a cognitive, thought-out thing. It's a felt thing. We feel a certain way. We feel like we are this kind of person. Are we? We don't know. We haven't really examined it, but we feel it. So there's a sense in which it's not just cognitive, but it's also emotions which really power up the self-concept. But it's a schema for how we experience the nature of ourself. Not who am I, Nick Bolton, in the 21st century as a business owner, but who am I, Nick Bolton, as a human being? What is my way of being human? Am I able to change or am I a fixed thing? Do I relate to people or am I essentially who I am and nobody can affect me? You know this classic phrase in coaching that says, nobody can make you angry. Has anyone ever made you angry? Let me ask you that. From an experiential perspective, has anybody ever made you angry? And be honest. Yeah, totally. So this notion that nobody can make you angry is not how we experience the nature of ourselves typically. If that's the case, you're probably a Buddhist monk. Right? That's the reality. So we experience ourselves in a particular way. That's our self-concept. So here are some of the ones I've come up with through my years of coaching. The first one relates to somebody's sense of their wholeness or not. And the way I look at it is this. There's the reflective self, which is somebody who's willing to reflect on who they're becoming, who they were, what's possible, what's not possible, and they are in a reflective state. Then there's the certain self. This is the person that thinks they know who they are. You hear this a lot. It's like, I'm a born procrastinator. I don't suffer fools gladly. Like as though that's a quality that is imbued in them and is unchangeable. It's a certain sense of who they are that is fixed. Then there's the uncertain self, which is the person that feels like, I don't know who I am, but I should know who I am. And not knowing who I am is a problem. That makes sense? So there's the reflective self that's like, yeah, curious. I wonder why I showed up here tonight like that, but over there I was like this. That's interesting. What's going on for me? Then there's a person that says, here's what I'm like, and I'm like that there and there and there and there and there. And it's just who I am. Then there's the person that's like, I don't know who I am. And that's a problem. In my experience as a coach, those are sort of three of the key ways of knowing yourself. Then we have the emergent self, the complete self, and the fractured self. Very related to how we know ourselves, but this is your sense of how you know yourself, this is your sense of wholeness. The emergent self is the idea that you're always changing. You're never whole. You are always in a state of emergence. So I think about myself when I was married the first time, from the age of 21 to 28, and I think, God, who was that kid? Like I look back now, I think at 28 I was a child. And the way I behaved with my wife, or the way I behaved in my job as a bank manager, which makes me laugh because I was a kid, like, I am so not this person here. Because we change all the time. Now, are you comfortable with the idea that in 5 years' time, or 10 years' time, or 20 years' time, you won't be who you are now? That's the emergent self that's at play. But then there's the complete self, which is, I'm here. This is just how I am. I'm not going to change. I never forget running one of my discovery days for coaching, and this lady said to me, but this involves a lot of learning, doesn't it? And I said, yeah, of course it involves a lot of learning. And she said, I'm through at learning. I've done all the learning I need to. I was like, as a human being, how could you ever want to be done with learning? But some people are. They feel complete. That's it. That's who I am. This is what I'm going to get to, and I'm okay with that. Then there's the fractured self, who feels themselves split in different ways. Like, part of me wants this, and part of me wants that, and oh, I feel tense and I'm torn because of these different things. And then NLP says, don't worry, we'll do parts integration and we'll figure you out because you're broken. No, not at all. If you can allow somebody to become an emergent self, then they will begin to find themselves in the process. Then we can look at the relational self. So this is how do people make sense of themselves in terms of other people. The first one is the relational self. I make sense of myself with people. So with Marcus, I'm this kind of person. With Forsy, I'm this kind of person. And that's okay because we affect each other differently. But then there's the mirrored self, which in Gestalt terms would be called the confluent self. This is the person that only sees themselves through the eyes of the other. If Forsy thinks I'm like this, damn, I'm like that. What? How? That's a problem for me because Forsy thinks this. What do I need to do to fix myself? Because all of a sudden I see myself through everybody else's eyes. But then you've got the separate self, who only sees themselves through their own eyes. Nobody can make me angry. Nobody can make me sad. I'm here, John Donne's island. Or in his case, he said, no man is an island. But of course, a lot of people feel very separate from other people emotionally or cognitively or behaviorally. And they feel like, I don't care what people say to me. I'll just be myself. Well, great if you're being authentic. But are you? So there's a sense in which the self is made up as either relational or separate or entirely confluent stroke mirrored. Then there's the authentic self, the idealized self, or the symptomatic self. And this comes from something called self-psychology by a guy called Kohut. I don't know if you guys know the psychologist Kohut. And he talked about the idea that many of us carry around an ideal self, which we strive to be. But in striving to be the ideal self, we move away from the authentic self. And in that move away from the authentic self, we create a symptomized self. It could be stress, it could be anxiety, it could be self-doubt, it could be fearfulness or procrastination, but somewhere the attempt to be like this when you're actually like that creates a symptomized version of yourself. Oops, let me just stop for a second. I just want to pause and go, don't do that. The ideal self knows how to use this. Is that where I think that's the last one, is it? Cool. I just want to pause for a second and really invite some thoughts on this. Like, either where do you see this in yourself, or where do you see this in your clients, or maybe in friends? I'm just curious, as you look at this, what comes up for you? What thoughts emerge for you as you start to think about self in these different ways? And what I would be interested in doing is exploring how does self-concept show up across those different time perspectives? Where has or does the fractured self exist? And you mentioned in the past, maybe it's in the future. It's hard to imagine, but maybe it's like, if I get married, like I'm thinking to get married, and if I get married, what's going to happen to myself? Do I become somebody there and somebody there? So the fractured self may exist even in the future for somebody, depending on how they make sense of it. So what we can start to do is map across those self-concepts with time, the past, the present, and the future, past negative, past positive, et cetera, et cetera. Making sense? And we start to notice where, when that person is talking, are they putting these versions themselves? So, I forget that. I just want to show you St. Jerome. I think he's just a lovely chap, just to break the ice. So that's St. Jerome considering time. I want to share one more thing before I talk about my client Paul, which is what are the emotions of time? So now we've talked about time perspectives. We've talked about the idea of self-concepts. Now I want to look at where do emotions exist in time or in relationship to time. And then I'm going to bring it all back to my client Paul. So past. In the past, really, we have regret. It's very hard to regret something you're going to do, isn't it? Let's be honest. It's pretty hard to regret something you haven't yet done. I really regret the decision I'm about to make. So typically, regret is a past-oriented emotion, as is guilt. It's a past. Even if you project guilt into the future, it's because you project your feelings even further than the action that does it. So I know that by doing this, I will feel guilty. So then the behavior becomes passed to the thing that's even further ahead in the future. Make sense? So I might know I'm going to do this, but I know that might know that here I can look back and say, I'm going to feel bad. Nonetheless, it's still a past-oriented emotion. Pride. You're not proud of something you haven't yet done. I'm so proud of the fact I'm going to build a business one day. No, you feel pride because of something you did. It's a past-oriented emotion. And likewise, anger can be, not only, but can be a past-oriented emotion. So when you're hearing somebody talk about regret or pride, guilt, maybe anger, then you know they're beginning to talk about something that's past-oriented. It could be past positive, past negative. Then we look at the emotions of the present. Happiness, joy, and contentment. If you feel happy, joyous, and contented, it's a present emotion. You might remember feeling it, which is a past one, but the actual emotion itself exists as a felt thing in the moment. Your guilt is past-oriented, your joy is present-oriented. Fear can exist right now. So what if you're facing a tiger, like your fear is very present. It's not fear of something that may happen in the future. So fear is an interesting one. Like anger, it has two tenses, fear of right now and fear of there. An anger of right here and anger of back there. Like, again, you wouldn't be angry about something that's going to happen. I'm so angry that Michelle's going to do this in about 10 minutes' time. It's just not going to happen. Sadness exists in the here and now. Anger and frustration in the here and now. And love. Who could forget love? Typically I do, which is why it's at the bottom. But what about the present? We have fear, again, anxiety. Let me just share, actually, anyone know the difference between fear and anxiety from a technical perspective? Like when we talk about fear versus anxiety?
Anxiety is more of a kind of a spread. It's taking that essence of fear and looking at it in a broader sense.
Yeah. So technically they say that fear is object-oriented and anxiety is not. So you're anxious, but you can't place it. It's just I woke up anxious on Saturday. We had four different training groups going on. I woke up anxious. Maybe I woke up fearful, actually, because I knew what it was about. But there was an anxiety. I was like, what's this anxiety? So it's more diffuse, whereas fear is more like, that's the thing I'm fearful of. Emotions of the future include despair, hopelessness. You don't despair the past. It's gone. You despair what might come or what probably won't come. Hope and hopefulness. And excitement. Those are the emotions of the future. So when you're talking about those emotions, you know you're now future-oriented. Okay, so I want to go back to my client. Where was he when he started? So to my mind, this is how I see him. He was an ideal self. He was a big man. He's a big man. He's like physically strong and tall and big. He saw himself as a man's man. He was a rugby player, a Marine. He was an ideal self. That was his ideal self. In the past, with what I call past positive and past negative, and as much as he looks at the past with a lot of loss, but he also looks at the past with a lot of pride. So there's a sense in which there's a past negative and a past positive playing, quite a lot of tension between the past for him. The emotion was really regret and anger that he was feeling now. He wasn't really feeling much more than regret and anger. Regret at the loss and anger at what happened to him. Why did his leg... He really felt that his body let him down. Like, it's almost like his body was separate from him. His body let him down. It exploded on the field. His heart gave up. So it's almost like he'd become angry at him, his own physicality. In terms of his self, he was what I would think of as a separate self in the present. So in terms of the present, he was a separate self with a present fatalistic kind of attitude, because he was not talking to any of his, he wasn't talking to his wife, he wasn't talking to his kids, he wasn't talking to anyone at all about how he felt about his experience. Nobody knew how he felt about his loss. Even his wife didn't know how he felt about it. And he didn't feel like he could do anything about it. So he had a present fatalistic perspective. His emotions were frustration and anger. And in terms of the future, there was no future being embraced. He planned it, but it was like strategic rather than emotional. He didn't want it. He was just like, I have to do this. I saw like looking back, I kind of see it as a violated self ahead of him. In other words, he predicted a violated self. Or a fractured self. In other words, he felt like he should be this, but he felt like he was gonna be that. So he's already predicting the fracturing of his self. Emotions, despair, hopelessness. Probably despair was too strong for where he was coming from, but essentially within that ballpark of hopelessness. He didn't feel like much was possible. Make sense? Where did he end? He ended here. It's past positive left in the past. In other words, he appreciated what he did in the past, but he left it there. I see this as one version of his authentic self, which he recognized, that was one version of me. It was there. Now a new version needs to emerge. And the feeling he had was pride. Pride of what he had achieved and what he could have achieved. He ended up being what you might think was present hedonistic with a relational self. The emotion was contentment and love. Now, by the way, this sounds very like, blimey, Charlie, that was good coaching. It wasn't as simple as that, you know? I mean, even now, he still has these wiggles between. But broadly speaking, this is where I'd say he ended up. He started to speak to his wife about how it felt. Well, one of the biggest conversations we had through the whole coaching journey was about his vulnerability. Not about being a rugby player or being a Marine or what his business might look like, but how is it to be vulnerable and share what it feels like to experience this loss with your wife? That was the biggest conversation we had. What was very intriguing for me was how he would use the word you all the time. He said, well, when you lose this, you feel da-da-da-da-da. And towards the end, I said, I don't normally control people's language, but I want you to do me a favor. I want you to try to say I. I want you to try and say, I feel like this when I lost this. And the minute he said it, I don't know if you guys remember the recording session, but he just went stum and stopped. And you could feel, literally feel through Skype. I mean, Skype's amazing for emotion. You could feel through Skype the emotion coming from him when he realized he was talking about himself. And there was something about allowing vulnerability to be what enabled him to move from the past to the present. It was so powerful. So he ended up being relational, speaking to his wife, sharing what it was like to lose this thing. His future suddenly felt like that it was something he would want to plan. And that he had an emerging self. He didn't know quite what he was going to end up as, but he could feel that there was a new version of him ready to emerge. So the feeling then was one of hope and excitement. Just want to share a couple more things before we close off. First thing's problems of time, to sum it up. Typically going to be regrets for what was. Problems of time, regret for what was. Problems of present, unhappiness for what is. Problems of the future, anxiety, fear, despair of what will be. Those are the kind of the classic problems that are time-oriented, if that makes sense. And very quickly, this is my perception of this. Why do people develop this schema? I think for a number of reasons. I think as human beings, we need to make sense of the world. So we make sense of ourselves as a temporal being in order to make sense of the world. We'd actually rather be fractured than uncertain. Because being fractured, we can actually make some sense of. But actually going, oh my God, I haven't got a clue what the world holds for me, feels very unpleasant existentially for us. So my sense is we develop this schema, even counter to our good feeling, as a way to achieve certainty in an uncertain world. There are shortcuts to support decision-making. If you think you're this kind of person, you can make decisions much faster than if you've got to rethink your identity. If you have an idea of what the past means for you, which is cut off and dried, then you can just make a decision based on that very quickly rather than have to rethink it. So I think there's a sense in which these are shortcuts to action. And lastly, going back to my good old existential one, just to gain certainty in an uncertain world. It's like our biggest, for me as a coach, it's what I see everywhere. People determined to find certainty in an essentially uncertain world. So I want to share some thoughts on coaching approaches. So the first one I kind of think is really, really useful is solution-focused coaching. Not something I do a lot, but I did it in the office very recently with our team. And I was like, okay, guys, classic miracle question. If you went to sleep tonight and a miracle happened so that when you woke up in the morning and your job was precisely how you want it to be, what would that be? And it was amazing to see the big smile on my finance manager Petra's face when she realized that finally Nick would stop buying stuff without giving her the receipt. And Petra and Nathan would finally start making sales and setting the sales invoice up correctly. It was like suddenly she could project herself into a future without having to think about the obstacles that stood in her way. So actually using like solution-focused coaching, miracle questions, taking somebody out of their existing condition to the future can overcome some of those future-oriented problem focuses. Phenomenological reduction. Anyone come across this before? In your cereal. phenomenological reduction. So phenomenological reduction is when you take something and you strip it of all interpretation. And you say, what actually happened? Don't worry about what led to it. Don't worry about what it means to the future. What was the actual experience you had, stripped of all time? Just explain to me the actual thing. What was said? Who said what? How did you feel? Rather than what does that mean for your future or where did it come from in your past? So phenomenological reductionism comes from existential practice. It can be an excellent way of de-timing things, taking the time out of things entirely. Working with the here and now. Who did my here and now masterclass? 3, 4, 5 of you? Yeah. So working in the here and now is a great way to move out of the temporal problems because you're literally just bringing them to the here and now. What is it like to feel this here with me? Forget what happened back then. Forget what might happen here. What is it like to feel it? So you bring people into the present experienced moment, the hedonistic present with you, the coach. They have to step out of their time perspective to be here with you. Any kind of here and now work is very powerful for people who are either negative future, negative past, fearful future, all that kind of stuff. Bring them to this moment. Timeline therapy from things like NLP, very powerful way to do it. One of the interesting things for me about time is not only do we have all these things we've talked about, but then we have the distance represented by time. In other words, if you have a negative past, where is that? Is it like right here? Or is it over there? If you have a positive future, is it like way over there? Or is it right here? What happens if you move that? What happens if you push that past away? So timeline therapy from NLP is all about playing with the mental timeline that we hold about our life. And then learning the lessons from that. So really kind of taking people back saying, okay, so this happened. What did you learn from that? But actually playing with the stretch of that time. Make sense? Ask them to push it back. It's very interesting for me. I had a very, very, very short timeline for a long time. Probably until about 2 years ago, my timeline was something like 6 months. By which I mean that my future was literally 6 months away and that was it. I had no long-term planning. Still don't to some degree. In terms of my personal life, none of this pension nonsense. But now I have a very long-term business plan, a very long-term business timeline. But 2 years ago, I wouldn't have done. Not at all. 6 months was as far as I could see. Are we going to fill up our group of students? in 6 months? Cool, we've got a business. Whereas now it's like, well, where are we going to be in 10 years? So my own timeline has shifted. We're not stuck with the timeline, but it takes coaching and it takes reflection to actually start to shift the length of your timeline either way. Future pacing and visualization from NLP, another great way to take somebody forward if they've got a very negative past orientation or a negative, fearful future orientation, is to actually take them through to a place and have them look back. Okay, so what was the last step you had to take to be here? And what was the last step you had to take to be here? Okay, very powerful to overcome some of those cognitive things by making them much more embodied. And perceptual time positions is a very interesting one. Who's come across perceptual positions in coaching? So, you know, the idea of that you have yourself and your boss and you sit in the boss's seat and you embody the boss and you say, da, da, da. Do that with time. Put the past in a seat, put the future in a seat, put the present in a seat, put death in a seat. I actually remember teaching existential coaching some years ago, and one of the students decided to be death, his future death. And he sat in his seat as his future death. And the coach was asking him, as your dead self, looking back on your life, what do you experience? What did it look like? What did you do? And he had to embody his dead self and say, Jesus, if I don't start doing something good now, I'm in trouble. And it woke him up. Very powerful. So anything you can do to take somebody out of their cognitive processes can be very powerful. Narrative coaching, good old narrative coaching, which Rob no doubt will touch on in his talk in April. So really looking at the stories people tell themselves and helping change that story. So what is the negative story that leads to this negative past? Or what is the fearful future that leads to the future they've got? And what's that story they're telling themselves? And who's in that story? And what's the plot line? And how could that plot line be different? And what are they missing from the story that makes it so negative? What are they forgetting? You know, it's funny, for many years, I've always been a very happy chappy, but it doesn't mean I can't think negatively of people. And when I left my first wife, I would look back and go, God, I can't believe how selfish she was, and I can't believe how this, and I can't believe how that. But it's only when you start to reauthor the story and say, what was my part in that, that everything changes. So like, how do we help our coaches take responsibility for rewriting their story? Not faking their story, just bringing stuff in they've forgotten to tell themselves for a long time. What was their part in it? Or what was that person's part in it? Or what have they forgotten to bring into the story? So when you start helping somebody retell their story, reauthor the story, as it's technically called, or remember the story, remembering the story is not remembering, it's remembering, bringing new people in who you've forgotten. Like Rob does a lot of work with young people. Young people forget who care for them. They remember the people who don't care for them, but they forget who cares for them. So when you say, what about your granny? They go, God, I totally forgot about granny. So you remember where the member is a person. So there's a lot you can do with narrative coaching to retell the past or the future without faking it. What you don't want to do is fake it. As in, yeah, don't worry about being sacked. You know, just tell yourself a different story. That's just faking it. You need to remember it in a different kind of way. So guys, thank you so much indeed, and see you at the next one. Thanks a lot. Thank you.